Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. From the suburbs of New Jersey to the clubs of New York to the top of the charts, musician John Popper has been pushing the boundaries of what's possible on his instrument for decades. Best known as the frontman for Blues Traveler, Popper has collaborated with just about everyone in the music world by now. But as he writes in his new memoir, Popper wasn't always a rock star. He started out as a socially awkward child who never did his homework. And in some important ways, his struggles continued into adulthood. The name of Popper's book is Suck and Blow and Other Stories I'm Not Supposed to Tell. And it's my pleasure to welcome John Popper to the Roundtable.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why did you want to tell your story at this time?
Well, I think that, you know, having a baby and getting married and, well, I'm 49, but, like, it feels like I'm hitting 50. I think at that point you start to see things differently. You certainly start to remember things differently, and I wanted to get this down before I started to really forget these stories. They've already been sort of altered over time from what happened when they happened. We used journals that I kept at the time, and then also my perspective now, and I think that was, I still had that connection. I wanted to do that now before I completely started to forget them because, you know, I'm not saying I'm senile, but it's coming, and I certainly look at things differently.
How so?
Well, I think your priorities change. You know, you want to, you're not quite as obsessed as you used to be about getting the last word or seeing to it that it's you know, the thing that you were, that was driving you crazy, was obsessing you. You learn to let those things go as you get older. You learn to just kind of, it's what they call, I call it the walk down and F them all versus, you know, there's this old joke about a calf and a bull, and the calf says, "Hey, Dad, let's run down there and diddle one of those heifers." And the dad says, "No, son, let's walk down and diddle them all." And there's that confidence that comes with that age. But also, the freshness of the story kind of leaves you. And so I think that's kind of the problem. And you want to catch that. Like, I feel like I wrote this book right at the right time. You know, it was sort of this nice balance of both.
A lot of times when musicians write their memoir, their bandmates aren't so happy about some of the things they say. Did you run it by your bandmates at all, or has that been an issue?
No, but they trusted me pretty much. I've heard about that. I've had friends in various comedy troupes and bands tell me about how that goes down. And, you know, maybe stuff will come up. But so far, they seem pretty pleased with what I've said. And I really tried not to throw anybody under a bus or implicate anybody in anything that would get them in trouble. I didn't feel the need to. I thought this book was more of a funny look at it. And, you know, there was some stuff that I covered that might have been not as funny, but that was more about me. You know, the only expert I can be is on the subject of myself. I don't think that I could really speak to the motivations of the people around me, even as we were that close and going through things together. It's hard to understand everyone else's motivation, but I think your own might be the hardest for you to grasp, but it's the only one you can speak to.
You know, you wrote this book to your infant daughter, or your baby daughter now, and left in a lot of the warts. And I kind of appreciated that as a reader. You talk about the scene in New York City in the 90s and everything that went along with it. You know, did you have to decide how honest you wanted to be?
I guess. I knew that I would have to be pretty, what I like to call thoughtlessly honest, where you're not really taking time to edit yourself. But that being said, I was working with Dean Budnick, and he would ask me questions, and we were both thinking what would be entertaining for the reader. So I didn't belabor points that may have infatuated me more. Like, you know, I think at that point it starts to turn into some sort of analysis. And the thing about analysis is it's fascinating to the person who's being analyzed, but it starts to get boring for everyone else. And so, you know, there was a feeling of catharsis writing this book, but I had to remember that wasn't the point. And I think to that, and I wanted to keep the stories as something that were graspable and kept it you know, I won't want to say kept it kind of light, but if it went somewhere poignant that I could actually go and take the reader with me, then I wanted to do that. But, you know, the way we did it is Dean would ask me questions, and I would start to riff and talk about them. And that's really kind of how, with the exception of that afterward that I wrote specifically to my daughter, that one I wrote. But the rest of it was more about me riffing. And we both found and agreed that when I'm riffing, sometimes I hit my best stuff when it isn't premeditated. I think when I'm premeditated, then I sometimes edit out the better part of what's good about me. And I'm certainly an honest one. And I think what's great about any work I've done, be it songs or this book, is the honesty. And if I'm good at being honest, then the rest of it will kind of fall where it is, and there'll be value to it somehow, to somebody.
I was surprised to learn that you were a fairly indifferent student, to say the least. You made a pact to not do homework because you were a history buff, and as you say, you kept meticulous journals. You're obviously extremely well-read. When you went to music school, you had prodigious talent. But how come school never caught on for you?
Well, first of all, thanks for saying all that. I don't know how well-read I actually am. I think I pick things up orally. And so, you know, if we were talking about The Great Gatsby or we saw the Robert Redford movie, then I could grasp it. But when we're actually reading Fitzgerald, I would have a lot of trouble figuring it out. I think I did a little better with Hemingway for talking the classics. But really, I read two books entirely cover to cover in my life. And one was The Amityville Horror in middle school, and the other one was Miles Davis's autobiography. And I've been dyslexic all my life, and it's really hard for me to grasp the printed word where it just becomes something. Like, for me, it was always television and movies or conversationally with people. And I think that might lend itself to why I've gotten good at using the English language. But as far as homework went, you know, in history, when there was something I liked, I would go and find out about it myself. And, you know, reference books, those are, you know, the Penguin Atlases, I would refer to them constantly. And so I guess I've read them, but it was never at once in a sitting. It was always to go back to a question I wanted to find out. And that was never in the coursework of elementary or high school. You know, we never got to do the fun stuff. So the fun stuff I had to go do on my own time. And, you know, what we learned about in high school was, you know, how the study of history applies to, you know, social studies applies to, you know, basically what you're learning a lot of in public school is, why do we need to learn this? And you have that discussion over and over again. And, you know, what most of the kids are thinking is, God, I will say anything and learn anything to get out of class. You know, let me just do the homework. Let me do the test so I can leave and have fun and do anything else than be in this class. Now, I loved history and I loved English, but what I loved was how you can use the English language to, or your perspective to kind of bend history or bend the English language to your will. You know, history is told by the winners, they say. And it's certainly something that can be questioned. It's certainly something that you can argue about. And that was the only little bit of daylight I needed to stall the class or have take the discussion where I wanted it to go. And that would make it much more interesting. And, you know, it was just sort of an instinct to be entertained and certainly to distract from us having the lesson plan correlate with the homework we were supposed to do. And if that could sabotage that, all the better. But what I really wouldn't do was math or science at all. Like, you know, I was in beginner chemistry by senior year, and I was doing pre-algebra right up till the end of school.
And you had two junior years.
Yes. And so, you know, math was a complete disaster. And what's funny is that music is a kind of math, but I didn't look at it that way. Had I looked at math like it was fun, I might have really gotten something out of it. And, you know, that's the shameful thing about it. I think what's wrong with education is that everybody's trying to appeal to the greatest number of people. But everyone is so different in how their brain works, and a lot of people slip between the cracks, and it isn't because they're stupid. Usually it's because they're interesting. And, you know, there isn't one encompassing system to teach all of the interesting people, because that's precisely what makes them interesting. They're beyond a simple system. And, you know, I'm really grateful to the teachers that didn't give up on me. I think what happens at that point is that if you find the right teacher, and there are some good teachers and there are some bad teachers, but if enough good ones see that you're interesting, they try to get interesting with you. They go outside of the coursework and they try and make it appeal to you. And when those very same teachers saw that I had some aptitude for the harmonica, they took me to the band teacher. And they, you know, Linda Smith, she was the special ed teacher that I was going to, you know, remedial resource. I can't remember what it was called, you know, alternate program or something like that. And she saw that I was playing harmonica, so she figured, this kid's smart. Let's put him somewhere productive. Because if you don't put the smart kid somewhere productive, then you start getting your Ted Kaczynskis. And, you know, luckily I sucked at science, so I wouldn't have known how to build a nail bomb. But, you know, what if I was good at science and then just stunted right there? You know, I think that happens all the time. I think that, you know, what we need to do, and I get more concerned about this as I have a daughter now. I can only imagine what kind of mind is forming under that soft skull right now. And I really hope that somebody holds her interest, or something holds her interest. Because the only thing more dangerous than a bored kid is a bored smart kid. And it isn't just dangerous for us, it's dangerous for them. It's sad. And I was really lucky. I was all the way in high school before I found something that could get me out of there, something that could get me anywhere. And I mean, for me, it was such a stark contrast. It was and so immediate. The day that they saw me play the harmonica, like officially in a school class, my life changed, like, immediately. It was a gift, you know, I could never repay. I mean, I guess the best way I can repay that, or attempt to, is to try and understand that about kids that are growing up, and try and remember that about that kid that seems like the troublemaker, or seems like the disruptive one. It's the disruptive kids are really the fuel, if you use them properly. I always say this to teachers, you know, don't punish that class clown. Put him to work for you. Get him on your side, you know. It may seem like a weird concept that, you know, teachers are working with students instead of it's an us-them thing. But the fact is that kids are not just going to sit there like robots and soak in what you want them to soak in. They're going to soak in whatever they're soaking in. And hopefully you've got the more interesting thing than what's out the window that they're staring at while they're daydreaming. And daydreaming is good. I wish I could have done more of that. I like to do that now. I think daydreaming is a hugely important part of just how the brain works.
Mm-hmm.
I wish there had been a class for that. You know, I would love to do that in some school that would, you know, allow that as a credited course, advanced daydreaming. You know, no, I know it sounds like there'd be drugs involved, but no, there wouldn't. We would stare out the window or stare at whatever we want. We just have to be there. And at the very least, you get some really good meditation time.
I've always had this one musical question I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
When you play guitar, you play bass, you build up calluses on your hands. When you play the drums, you know, your forearms are toned. What happens in your mouth when you get to be the level of harmonica player you are? I mean, do you have like
You got really good lips.
Okay.
Your jaw is definitely strong. You know, I can lift my wife's entire head off of my face with my tongue. If you spend a lot of time developing an embouchure, it does pay you back that way. It's like any muscle, and you develop it and you work it. And I can talk a long time before I get tired. I can bite down really hard. I can I have really good breath control and the use of my breathing. I can, you know, hold my breath or at least use it sparingly. And sometimes with what breathing tricks I know, you learn to hold a long note. I think when I use a marine band, for instance, that those are wooden harmonicas with tin on top of them. I prefer a Special 20 or my new design, you know, my harmonica, the Fenders. They have plastic bodies that are, the comb part is what I'm talking about, is made of plastic, so it doesn't cut your face. When the wood swells with any kind of humidity, the little wood protrusions start to swell and stick out, and it becomes like a little sort of a saw, like teeth. And as you're sliding that in and out of your face, you start to cut each side of your lips. So you sort of get a callus there. And, you know, it certainly beats a callus on your fingers. I'm not sure what a guitar player could do with those. It sounds painful, just the thought of it.
You write in the book a lot about Blues Traveler having identified this middle-class identity. You guys put out a record. If it doesn't do great, that's okay, because you're still good on the road. You're always going to have that touring identity. And I just wonder what you see as the future of your group now.
What I meant by that is on a year when everybody's having a great summer, we do okay.
Mm-hmm.
And on a year when everybody's having a terrible summer, we do okay. I would say we started touring as like a professional bit. You know, that's 87 is when we started. So maybe touring with a bus and a band, that probably started in 1990, you know, where you had like overhead and insured everybody. But for every year, we were always making a profit and living pretty well. We weren't living huge, we were living good. And the advantage of that, I always felt, was that it never went away. Like that's something we've managed to continue to do. Each year we've managed to account for inflation, and we've managed to keep paying our bills and staying in comfortable homes that we own and paying our mortgages off. And, you know, I think that when you start getting into 30 years, it's that becomes valuable when you look back at it. And I think that is a thing that a lot of bands, you know, that are my age are learning how to do and kind of mastering. But I think for many bands that we know about, you know, that one would know about, there's this huge arc of their career where they're doing stadiums and then it falls off to nothing. And I don't think it could have been because we were involved with Horde. We never went off and did stadiums on our own. We just kind of tried to incorporate with other bands, and it always seemed to me that we might have done an amphitheater or two, but it was largely the theater thing. And it's because we toured so much. We would hit an area several times a year, and when you do that, you don't really play a stadium because then you've taken the whole market all at once. And somehow that's just created a system for us that's worked really well. What's interesting now is that we finally learned after 20-something years how to sell things out in advance, because we were always walking up our audience. We would walk up a sellout, but it was the day of the show and people would still be buying tickets. It would drive us crazy. It would drive the promoters crazy.
Why was that?
We just habituated our audience to buy tickets last minute, and the tickets would be there, and it was just this system that worked, but it made it very hair-raising for us. And the system we have now is putting things on sale really early and getting the word out. I think we were pretty sloppy about getting the word out about shows. A lot of people would be like, I didn't know they were in town. Now when somebody says that, they find out that it's sold out. And that's a good feeling. I think that makes everybody go, all right, I got to catch them next time. And it starts habituating an audience into, you know, getting the tickets early, which is certainly better for us. Then we get to walk around like we feel, you know, we get to walk around pretty smug, and the promoters are a little nicer to us. But the truth is, as long as they show up, we're grateful.
Well, John Popper is the author of a new memoir called Suck and Blow and Other Stories I'm Not Supposed to Tell. John, I've been trying to catch one of your harmonicas since I was a kid, and I guess I'll just keep trying. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I will make sure we get you one. I think we can arrange that.
Sounds great.
Thanks again.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.